Welcome to Real Deal Recovery, where the focus is topic-based and centered on physical and emotional recovery from drugs and alcohol or any other self-destructive behavior. Here's your host, Stephen Gerard.
Greetings. Today we have a special guest who I'll be interviewing on the topic of creativity and recovery. While many of you listening may not be involved in creative endeavors, our guest today, Clark, has decades of clean and sober experience, and he's incredibly funny, so I can pretty much guarantee you this pod's going to be of value. Clark's been a very successful working artist since the 60s, and we are so very grateful to have him with us today. Clark, welcome to Real Deal Recovery.
Thank you.
You know, I'd like to start with, if it's okay with you, your last year of drinking and drugging and your first year of recovery.
Okay. We were talking about the year 1978, 1979. Before that, I'd been able to pretty much go for long periods of time without drinking, but my parents were both, the very Native American, and they really drank like Native Americans, like flat down on the floor, violence, crazy stuff. My father was the king of, the geographic. I went to 14 schools in 12 years. He was very violent, crazy stuff. So I ended up getting into art and music as a kind of an escape. And probably my real drug of choice would be art and music. And I had this girlfriend. Things started going south after about 5 years. And all of a sudden, I started from going to be able to control my drinking, because I didn't want to be like my parents. I started drinking alcoholically, and I became a dipsomaniac. You know, I had a insatiable craving for alcohol, and I didn't know I could maybe go for 6 weeks, a month without, with maybe having a beer a day. But at the end of that time, there was a blackout drunk there. And then funny thing was, is I was like Charlie Chaplin when I got drunk. I could do crazy things. And I was kind of like doing, you know, apologizing nine-step stuff before I even got in the program. But if I could remember what I did, and then I'd ask people what I did, and they'd tell me, and it was, you know, like this one guy, I was in a bar, and I was drinking scotch, and I was leaving, and they go, Clark, you know, we'll buy you a drink. And I go, oh, I got to go. No, come on in. So I go down, had a couple more drinks, and the next thing I know, I'm going crazy. Ended up chasing some religious nut, and I was pulling his hair out and stuff like that, and they pull me off, and then I asked what did I do, and he goes, don't you remember what you did? And I go, no, what did I do? And he said, you don't remember making out with my fiance? And I'm like, what? And I said, why didn't you stop me? He said, we couldn't stop laughing, man. You were like, it was just so funny, it was like comedy. And everywhere I go, I do real crazy stuff. But also, the violence thing was really getting to me, and I thought that I was going to end up killing somebody because, you know, Native Americans, the tribe I'm from, the Cherokees are intermixed with way back with the Vikings, and it's the meanest tribe in North America. And so everybody in my family, just all we did was beat each other up, sober or not sober. And I knew that I had a problem, and I was painting. And I remember I painted two great paintings that are out in L.A. that have been shown around the country that I actually painted while I was drunk. And then I ran into a friend who had gone, when I'd gone to some art school at in New York. I didn't know this guy very well, but I got to know him years later. And then I was talking to him. We were both artists, and he said, how are things going? And I said, I'm making lots of dough doing this, living the life. But I, you know, felt suicidal, and I thought I had a drinking problem. So he said, oh, I've got some friends. You need any help? And I thought, uh-oh. I knew it was probably AA. So the funny thing was, is I kept running into this guy like about four times, and I'd always said I'd go to a meeting, but I was Mr. Busy, you know, King Baby, sort of. That kind of thing. And finally, I ran into him on a lone street. He lived miles away from where I was, and he was sitting in a truck in the middle of nowhere in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. And so I said, oh, Fred, hey. And I said, about that meeting, because I just felt like I was being kind of a, you know, bullshit artist, you know, saying, yeah, I'll go to a meeting. So I said, what about the meeting? He said, I'll pick you up tomorrow at, 6:30. So the next day I went to the meeting, he picked me up, and he would take me every week. He'd drive in from kind of way out in Maryland. And I knew from the first meeting that this was the answer, that total abstinence was the only thing that was going to work for me. And I tried all kinds of different techniques for controlling, and they always ended up in, really weird thing. And then I'll tell you what really got me, Stephen, was that I said that if I got as bad as my father, I knew I'd have to stop. But I felt like I'd already gone past where my father was, And I got to the point where I would be so mocus all day long from the hangovers. I was drinking more daily, or I would drink during the day. So if I had to go out at night, I would be sober, but I was, it was terrible. And I was a total atheist. I've been an atheist since I was 10. So I had a hard time with the six of those God steps, but I made the group my higher power. And that worked for about 5 years. And then I was starting to get shaky at about 5 years. And then I had I didn't have the hot flash like Bill G. Wilson, but I was in the big cathedral in Venice, Italy, and I had some kind of weird hocus-pocus thing came over me. And then I sort of started working on the higher power thing. And I ran into some girls at Anchors Away, the clubhouse in Key West, Florida, and they said, have you done your fourth and fifth step? And I've been in the program 5 years, and guess what? I had not done the fourth and fifth step. So they got me to do the fourth and fifth step, and so I was on my way. And then, I was a slow, kind of slow learner, but I never relapsed after. I went to about three meetings, and there was a lady who was an art collector who had a dinner party, and she'd have people like Mark Rothko and people like that come over. She was had great art and everything. And I had a glass of wine, and I went in the kitchen and picked up the bottle and started, and she said, hey, Clark, what are you doing? And I said, I thought I'd have another glass of wine. And she said, is that all right? And she said, it's all right, but I thought you were going to AA. And I, as I'm pouring the glass, I'm looking over the glass at, I said, I am. And you should have seen the look on this lady's face. It scared me straight. Like I went, wait a minute. I got to really, this is it. And I'll tell you, Stephen, I had no idea that was going to be my last drink, but that was the last drink. It was like November 8th, 79.
So you've been clean and sober now, 37 years? Is that right, Clark?
Well, I'll be 37. I'm in my 37th year. I'll be 37 okay. November 8th.
Because the topic for this podcast is creativity mm-hmm. and recovery. When you in your first year, when you're getting clean and sober, did you take a break from making art to concentrate on your recovery, or was that an issue?
I went full blast on my art, but the funny thing was is that I guess we were talking off mic about how so many people in acting and theater and everything, they think that the booze makes them gets the juices going and all that, and I think I kind of had a little of that. But, they all end up either dying from between age 27 and 44 if they go that route. And I knew that total abstinence was going to have to do it. What I didn't really realize is that really need, in my opinion, you need to work the steps if you're going to get the happy, joyous, and free thing. And like I said, I had those two paintings I did in 1978, 79 that were like painted when I was loaded, and they were really great paintings, but it never changed. My art thing, my life changed, but my art thing, it was a thing. I didn't feel like painting anymore. I felt like drinking, like I'd be hungover. And then about 5 o'clock when I'd feel like it was time to start painting, it was like cocktail time at that point. And that wasn't cutting it. So I knew I had to change my life. And then I was really discriminated against in the art field because, I wasn't into smoking pot or doing smack or anything like that. So I was not Mr. Fun as far as like a lot of the art world kind of or creative people were like, I was Mr. No Fun or I think a lot of people respected that I didn't drink. I mean, people would come up to me and say, "What's in that glass? What's in that glass?" And I said, "Oh, it's just ginger ale." And they said, "Are you sure?" And I go, so there were people actually were looking out for me. So, you know, sometimes you think like people, you know, they're against you drinking. They want you to drink. But in my case, I had an art dealer that I got kicked out of the gallery because I wouldn't drink with the guy anymore. But he died drunk. Not too long after that, and I could drink that guy under the table. But I think it got me more going on a spiritual path, which I think AA is all about, a spiritual path. It's not. I never really did think it was religion. Like a lot of people go in and think it's religion, but it gets you into a spirituality, which I think art is very spiritual, and, you know, it just makes it better.
So how has your spirituality influenced your art?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think it just changed. Like, I was a very angry person, but when I came in, no higher power. I was kind of like, you know, like that, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre and that existential, their life is a ball of shit, and, you know, we're just toughing it out and blah, 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 shit happens and stuff like that. I mean, it was, you know, like the Rolling Stones. I like sort of the blues music, you know, everything was kind of down and out, and you know, life is a hard loaf of bread and blah blah blah. And you know, getting into these different like spiritual type things, you find that, you know, there is kind of a joy. You can have, even as bad as it is, sort of seems today, I have a very joyful life. And it's you know, it's really worked for me, but I think you have to really work on it. A lot of people, and I can say, like in my first 5 years, I was kind of dumb about AA. I mean, I had these, if anybody was super religious, that never bothered me. A lot of people get crazy and stuff. It wasn't the, you know, some meetings that people would be mentioning some holy man's name and people get all incensed. That never bothered me, but I just didn't have a concept of a higher power for a long time, and that was a big mistake. I mean, I think I could write a book, AA for Idiots, you know, if you want to have to get on the happy, joyous, and free thing. I mean, I finally hit that in one of the pages of the book, and it was like, what? Happy, joyous, and free? Are you kidding? And then that was like sort of step six, you know, do you really want to get rid of your misery, you know? I mean, a lot of people, they, you know, in the art world, like it's all angst and, you know, Jackson Pollock and his demons and blah, blah, blah. And Jack got sober for about a year. I don't think he actually went to any meetings, but his psychiatrist died, and then he got really super resentful. If you see the film, they kind of, when Hans Nemuth was doing the painting of him underneath a piece of glass, and he was painting, and they were having a party, and he just started wildly drinking beers, and then the rest of his life was circling the drain. And he died at 44.
Now, Clark, what influence has working the steps had on your personal life as it relates to your art?
Well, I never thought I would get so involved in the program, you know, the primary purpose and helping other people. But I spent a lot of time trying to work with people that are in the arts or music. And like, I think somebody that just passed away who'd gone to some meetings from the Stone Temple Pilots, Scott Weiland, my cousin, ran a sober living house out in Culver City, and I lived with Scott for a couple of weeks, and he basically got thrown out of the thing for flushing a beach towel down the drain, down the toilet, which keeps sounding weird. And some of these guys, they get to this point, their heads are so big from the adulation, you know, 40,000 people screaming in a theater or something, you know, in a big stadium, and the pressure of touring and up and down, and, you know, a lot of them, you know, it's really hard to get off of a lot of the stuff. And I just try to help a lot of people if they want to get some help to, you know, forget about controlling drinking or drugging. It just doesn't, if you really got that issue, you know, you really have to, like Dr. Young told Bill Wilson, you know, total abstinence is the only thing that really works. But without total abstinence, when I was doing the first 5 years, I was like very angry. I was basically on a dry drunk, and I was sponsoring people and everything, but I might have looked okay from the outside because I had some hardcore people that I was doing really good work with, but I wasn't really very happy. I was resentful that I couldn't drink anymore. It was real strange.
Now, Clark, it was about that time that you really started, if I remember correctly, that's when you really started to start working the steps. Is that correct? And mm-hmm. then that's when things turned around in terms of your well-being, right?
Yeah, I was heading for a kind of weird bottom at 5 years. Like, you know, I was where they say, you know, people get shaky. And I was getting shaky. I didn't really feel like drinking. I sort of took the pledge that I wasn't going to drink, but I was not having any fun. And I think that happens to a lot of people that they get into AA and they just feel miserable, you know, like, what am I, you know, I go to the meetings, I do this, I do that. But, and eventually they could, you know, fall out. If you get in and say like, well, I got an allergy to alcohol and you do any, you know, do read the literature and find out how the guys formulated the program and everything. And they had, you know, those guys, Wilson and Smith had really super bad stories, you know, and they were able to overcome it and do the thing. So it's better to help other people and, you know, work on your own spirituality than be dead or on the gutter or, you know, bumping along the bottom.
In your opinion, why do you think so many artists feel that they need to have their drug of choice to make art?
Well, I think you have to be kind of crazy to be an artist, even... You know, actor, you know, all these people are a little different. Artists are different. And, you know, I think they're just sort of drawn to, you know, like in the beatnik thing, they call it kicks and stuff like that. Everybody wants to have a wild time and, you know, the booze and the stuff. You hear so many stories of people like, oh, it was like blah, blah, blah. And then I discovered booze and then my life turned around and I was the life of the party and blah, 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 blah. So I think it can sneak up. It snuck up on me because I'd gone for, during the Vietnam War, I was against the war, and I belonged to a group that drugs and alcohol were counter-revolutionary. And I had some experience in 1966 where somebody gave me some pills. I didn't even know what it was, and I thought I was going to rock off. And then I just made a decision that that was it. I wasn't even trying to experiment with drugs. I never even bothered to do drugs. So all I had was the alcohol thing, and I knew that could become a monkey on my back, which it really did. And I was, a lot of Native Americans, it has the highest suicide rate in the country of any nationality. And I'm always, you know, I have suicidal ideations even today. I don't know what, I was just reading this about Native Americans, and I thought, like, what is it, you know? So the spirituality keeps me in the light and not getting into the dark, you know.
What do you do when you have those suicidal thoughts?
Well, actually my drug of choice is art. So mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time just painting away or, you know, now I've got into doing some chanting or doing kind of my painting is like a meditation, and I can paint like 10, 12 hours a day, even more than that at sometimes. Not everybody. A lot of people don't have that kind of patience, but it seems like people from the East can, you know, mindlessly work on things for millions of hours without it bothering them. And so I'm lucky in that sense.
And you don't meditate formally, so you see your work as meditation. Is that correct?
Yeah, I can sit there for maybe 15 minutes and totally meditate. But, you know, like I think I said, you know, people in the arts have this kind of wacky mind thing. It's jumping around. It's doing, I have weird flashbacks all the time. It's almost like, and when I say flashback, everybody thinks of acid, which I never did, but my mind, I can be sitting there and all of a sudden I just see pictures. Like I'll be in Key West, I'll be in Paris, France, I'll be places where I've been. It's just really weird. It's like when you take a channel, you're channel surfing, and it's like really weird. But I think since I started really getting into the meditation, and then I found these things where you can put on, like, listen to alpha waves or theta waves or beta waves. They say you can get, I'll sit there for 20 minutes and just stare at a kind of screen. And that's supposed to be work just like meditation. And then, you know, I don't think about anything. So I guess it is a form of meditation. But it really is something to work on. And everybody, a lot of people have a really hard time getting into it. But I just say, if you do, you just have to keep, it's like going to the gym. You know, you go to the gym, you work your way up. You know, go half an hour a day, hour a day, hour and a half a day, you know, whatever your thing is. It takes a while to get your deal together.
What would you tell the person who's listening that's in their first year of recovery? What advice would you give them?
Well, I think with a lot of people, I was so crazy. You know, they say don't date anybody. Well, I had like 3 girlfriends during my first year of the program, and I was able to do that. It was sort of my, I guess it replaced booze, but people, places, and things, try to stay away from, you know, you really got to follow some of the dummy, you know, I used to think the slogans were really stupid, but the slogans are really pretty good. You know, they really make a lot of sense. And, you know, don't drink, go to meetings, you know, try to get more and try to get involved. Like I find like some guy, I was in a meeting out in the country not too long ago, and the guy who had 40 years was saying, Clark, you go around like you're running for mayor, you know. I go around to all the newcomers and shake hands with them, and I always remember their name because you feel like you're on the outside. A lot of people go in and it seems real clicky, you know, and a lot of the people do, you know, they're not doing like Bill Wilson did, you know, where you're supposed to go around and make the people feel welcome. And it's like a new family. And you really, you know, I did do service, but, you know, I was kind of like the guy that sat on the back row with sunglasses, and I never spoke in a meeting for 5 years, so nobody really got to know anything about me. You know, I was a real hard case. I mean, I didn't drink, but I was really hard. I was very hard on myself. A lot of people seem to have low self-esteem that have the alcohol problem, and that's something that you got to work on because, you know, it can be a real problem.
Thank you so much for coming over today to do this podcast. You're a power of example. Thank you again.
Hey, thanks for having me, and happy trails.
Stephen Girard is available for sober coaching and consulting. Just visit realdealrecoverypod.com. That's realdealrecoverypod.com and the Work With Me tab. Make a decision to change your life.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you find this content of value and you'd like to have the podcast delivered directly to your device, please rate, review, and subscribe over on iTunes. This way, each new pod will be delivered directly to you and you won't have to go looking for it. We have some new blogs that may be of interest to you, and you can find those over at www.realdealrecoverypod.com. If you'd like to get a hold of me for any reason, or you'd like to suggest a topic, or if you have any questions pertaining to recovery, you can reach me directly at realdealrecoverypodcast@gmail.com. That's realdealrecoverypodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again for tuning in. And remember, recovery is not a spectator sport. Get in the ring.